put down his camera and picked up a mop.
You see migrants in Britain, you see them delivering parcels, you see them cleaning toilets. This is a lesson about what migrants and refugees offer to their host communities.
An award-winning Syrian filmmaker puts documentaries on pause to help fight the pandemic any way he can. Also today, running a cash register at a bodega in New York might not seem super stressful. During a pandemic, it is.
I haven't ever thought of fear going to work. Simple fear, like waking up the next day.
And one of the minor tragedies of this pandemic, relatively speaking, barrels of beer are being poured down the drain in London.
You know, I would rather give it away than have to throw it away. It's dreadfully sad.
I'm Marco Werman. Those stories and more today here on The World. Even one life is precious. Those were the words this afternoon from Tedros Ghebreyesus, the head of the World Health Organization, said we all need to come together to fight the coronavirus pandemic.
If there is national unity, and if there is global solidarity, if we take this as a common enemy for humanity and give our best, of course, understanding that this is a new virus and dangerous virus, we can win the fight. We can.
In an impassioned plea, Ghebreyesus said, let's not play with fire. The coronavirus has infected nearly 2.5 million people worldwide. Nearly 170,000 people have died from COVID-19. Those are only the confirmed cases. Scientists warn those figures are likely much higher. Today, Ghebreyesus stressed the underlying reality. Behind the numbers are human lives.
Anyone dying is the father, mother, grandfather, grandmother of somebody. It's life.
Ghebreyesus said humanity has not confronted anything like this since the 1918 flu. And just like then, Ghebreyesus said the disease we're confronting today is highly contagious and extremely deadly. He said this time around we have modern technology to help. But Ghebreyesus stressed again and again, nations of the world must work together to stop the spread of disease.
I know what poverty means. I know what war means. I know what killer disease means. I know what is behind all these problems. And I have been warning, we have been warning from day one. This is a devil that everybody should fight.
Beyond the grim statistics are also stories of many people stepping up to help. Small acts of selflessness, like shopping for an older neighbor who can't get to the store, or people sewing protective masks for strangers. Then there's the story of Hassan Akkad. He's a filmmaker in London. His documentary Exodus tells his own story of fleeing the Syrian civil war. 3 years ago, he was accepting an award from the British Academy of Film and Television Arts.
For you to understand how surreal this moment for me is, exactly 20 months ago, I was on a dinghy trying to cross from Turkey to Greece, and I'm here right now. It's...
But when the coronavirus hit, Hassan put down his camera and began another job as a cleaner in his local hospital.
So I work 8 hours a day, 7 to 3. When we get there, we are given uniform. So our clothes go into a separate bag, and then we put our uniform on, and then put our PPE on. And then I work at one of the COVID-19 wards, and I start scrubbing and disinfecting the tables, the bed frames, every touch point, like everything that you can touch with your hand. Mop the entire floor, and it takes me like 7 to 7.5 hours, and then take a shower and come back home.
So I'm just really curious what this experience has been like for you. Specifically, like, was there something with the pandemic that you did not really understand before taking this job, and now you do get it?
Yes. So I have an issue with the rhetoric that this pandemic is the great leveler. I keep hearing this phrase everywhere.
And when you say the great leveler, it's the kind of disease that we have been told will attack everybody regardless of wealth or class or et cetera.
Which is true. It does attack everyone, but we don't experience it similarly. Because, you know, like self-isolating in a mansion in the suburbs of California isn't like self-isolating in a refugee camp in Idlib in northern Syria or in one of the Greek islands like Lesbos, Moria camp. When you have access to medical health and when you can actually get on a ventilator and things accelerate, that's great. But if you're in a refugee camp, because I'm speaking as a refugee. If you're in a refugee camp, there is no running water, there is no hand sanitizers, and you cannot technically self-isolate in a tent. So I don't think it's the great equalizer or the great leveler. I know it's we're all going through this, but we are experiencing it differently.
Hassan, there's a video that's been making the rounds in the UK. You've probably seen it. You clap for me now is the hashtag. Two media producers put it together, and we see a number of immigrants speaking about, and you may think it's they're speaking about themselves, strangers from overseas taking your jobs, but it's actually the coronavirus they're talking about.
You clap for me now.
You cheer as I toil.
Bringing food to your family.
Bringing food from your soil.
Propping up your hospitals.
Not some foreign invader.
A delivery driver.
Teacher.
Lifesaver.
And the plea from these various essential workers that you're clapping for me now, so don't forget who we are and why we're essential when this is over. It sounds like some of this resonates for you.
100%. Can I tell you about, like, personally, from my own words, okay? My colleagues are from Nigeria. They are from Ghana, Poland, Spain, me, I'm Syrian. 99% of my COVID ward colleagues are migrants and refugees. We have left our loved ones and our families behind so we can be on the front line to help this country combat coronavirus. When this nightmare is over, I'm hoping that this will start an international discussion about how we treat migrants and refugees, because for years now, the anti-migrant rhetoric has been on the rise. We've shut our borders and we put kids in cages and we've sent boat backs and we call them leeches. And it hurts. But you now you see migrants in Britain, you see them delivering parcels, you see them stacking shelves, you see them cleaning toilets. This is a lesson, I think, to everyone around the world about what migrants and refugees offer to their host communities.
So you may be cleaning now, Hassan, but you're still a filmmaker. Has this experience given you some ideas for a movie, maybe?
It has. I mean, I'm learning on a daily basis. To be honest, I am also guilty of living in my own bubble because all my friends here are like, they have a term for them, like champagne socialists, like we. But now I am mixing with the people from other classes and people of other experiences, and I'm listening to their stories and I see how they are going about their lives during this. You know, like filmmakers are storytellers. And while my priority now is to clean and disinfect the toilets and the COVID wards, I do want to tell the story.
Hassan Akkad is a Syrian filmmaker. He's been working as a cleaner at a hospital in London where he lives. Hassan Akkad, thank you very much for being with us.
My pleasure. Thank you.
Beer is food. Food is not beer, as the saying goes. And like food, beer also has a sell-by date. When you're a pub owner in the UK and you have, on average, 15 kegs in storage waiting to be tapped, well, you've got an inventory problem on your hands right about now, which is why many pub owners are finding themselves in the sad position of literally pouring gallons of beer down the drain. From London, the world's Orla Barry has more.
When Britain went into lockdown in March, the pubs were the last places to shut their doors. Now, 4 weeks on, bar owners, or publicans as they're called here, worry that they could be the last businesses to open back up again.
I think that we're probably looking at 6 months. If we're open by September, that would be a bonus. If we're open by Christmas, that would be great.
Philip Cutter runs the Murderer's Pub in Norwich in East England. Its official name is the Gardener's Arms, but in 1895, the landlady's daughter was murdered by her husband, and the nickname stuck. This week, Cutter shared a video of himself, clearly upset, as he poured out 50 gallons of ale.
So to actually have it thrown down the drain is heartbreaking. You know, I would rather give it away than have to throw it away. It's dreadfully sad.
Cutter says he worried about getting in trouble with his insurance company if he sold that beer or even gave it away for free. That ale came from open casks. Like most publicans, he has plenty more unopened barrels of beer in stock, but the sell-by date on those is looming too. A consumer group called Camera, the Campaign for Real Ale, estimates that in less than 2 months, publicans will be dumping something like 50 million pints of beer. But a few pub landlords are finding novel ways to avoid that. Here's Camera's national chairman, Nick Antona.
I've heard of clever licensees approaching their local chip shop and saying, do you want some beer that can be used for beer batter and for fish and chips and things like that? But there's only so much of that you can use.
Others, like brewer Richard Muir in the English town of Ilkeston, are taking a different approach. Muir put a message on Facebook saying he could deliver beer to his customers' homes. And the idea went over well.
And we were so surprised the amount of people that came to us, or can we have a delivery? Regular customers of the pub that really wanted to support us. And like, it's nice to be providing a service that hopefully puts a smile on people's face when, one, they see someone through a door and then they get to have a drink and make it seem a bit more like normality.
Muir and his wife Mandy run a brewery and a small local pub called the Weybridge Inn. Opening his own brewery 10 years ago was Muir's dream. And when the lockdown began last month, he was seized with dread.
You're thinking, you know, potentially we're going to lose everything. We're going to lose a business. We could lose a house. It's done for the greater good. People's health's more important than a business. But then it's just a case of trying to find a way around to survive and bring some money in, because our income would literally be nothing.
Muir says he's making a quarter of his usual income right now. Back in Norwich, Philip Cutter says he's living on credit cards. His staff are furloughed, and he's still waiting on promised government funding to arrive. So I ask him if he's worried about going out of business.
Yes and no. I think my concern is probably more for my staff than it is for me. Sorry, I'm getting upset. I think the sadness is that day before lockdown, a Norwich publican committed suicide. And that's more upsetting.
Cutter says no one knows what caused that bar owner to take his own life. But the current situation probably didn't help.
Pub's an integral part of everybody's life. Everyone has a story about a pub and a good landlord. And I think when you get to a stage where people are taking their own lives because they can't see a way forward because of this, there was clearly other issues there. But the coronavirus has taken a lot of lives. So there's bigger things out there to worry about.
Cutter says he's staying in touch with his staff on WhatsApp and he hopes they'll feel free to share their worries with him. I ask Nick Antona what he misses most right now.
Not meeting my friends. I class myself as a social drinker. I very much like sitting with my mates and having a good chinwag and having a conversation while enjoying the beer and in a pub.
Some fear that this global pandemic could be the death knell for many British pubs, and that the public will just get used to drinking at home. But not brewer Richard Muir.
It's not just about the beer or whatever the drinking. It's to go in there and meet the friends. I don't think you'll ever eliminate pubs in this country. It's too much of ingrained in society. Drinking at home is all well and good, but it's not the same as being in the pub with your friends.
For The World, I'm Orla Barry in London.
Just ahead on The World, the science of sewage. We're learning more every day about the ways that the novel coronavirus can be spread. One place researchers are looking are sewers and what we flush down the toilet.
As high as 50% of people reported with COVID-19 shed the virus in their stool, and also the virus can multiply within the intestinal tract.
What our waste is telling scientists about COVID-19. Also coming up, can you be immune to this thing? Antibody testing may provide false hope to those who see it as a way to restart the economy. You're listening to The World. There's a lot of excitement about antibody tests right now. To be clear, these are not tests to see whether you currently have COVID-19. These are tests that can detect whether you've been exposed in the past. These antibody tests may be key to getting people back to work and restarting stalled economies, but some researchers are asking whether the tests can deliver on their promise. That includes Dawn Bodish. She studies the immune system at McMaster University in Ontario. I asked her why it's difficult to create tests that can detect antibodies for COVID-19.
There are coronaviruses that have been causing colds and flus for a very long time that are in the population. And there's some concern that some of the antibodies that recognize these seasonal coronaviruses will also recognize SARS-CoV-2.
So if we get accurate tests, antibody tests, that can detect the presence of antibodies, how much does that tell us and what can we do with that information?
It's incredibly important. So what will happen is we can understand how many people were actually infected. As I'm sure you've heard, one of the intriguing features of this virus is a lot of people are asymptomatically infected. So how do you test someone who has no symptoms? Well, in most of the world, we haven't been doing that as well as we should have. So when we get these antibody tests, we'll be able to see everybody who's ever been infected. That will really help us make some predictions. I mean, one of the things that would be optimal in future outbreaks, which we are unfortunately expecting, we might be able to make better regional decisions if we knew what proportion of the population were protected from infection. So as an example, you might expect that the people of New York might be slightly protected from the next outbreak because of the high rates of infection there. There's the caveat to that, though, is we need these tests to be accurate. And we also really need to understand how long protective immunity lasts. There's some disturbing hints from other related viruses that the protective immunity may not last forever.
Well, here's Dr. Maria van Kerkhove. She's the head of emerging diseases and zoonosis at the WHO, and she's underscoring the point you're making, Dawn.
Right now, we have no evidence that the use of a serologic test can show that an individual is immune or is protected from reinfection.
And Dawn Bodish, even if someone is immune, who knows how long that immunity would last? This is pretty uncharted territory, isn't it?
Exactly. Unfortunately, we can't rush time. And until I can't tell you if immunity lasts 6 months until we've had people who were infected and recovered for 6 months. I can't tell you if it will last 2 years until we've had somebody who's survived the infection for 2 years. We can start making some educated guesses. But if we look at SARS and MERS, we can expect protective immunity for maybe 6 months to 3 years. Obviously, if you don't have protective immunity, this means you can be infected a second time. And this is something that would have profound impacts on how we deal with future outbreaks.
So you're saying that when it comes to the tantalizing idea of immunity, antibody tests still are not super accurate in giving us what we need to know?
If I can give you a couple examples, you can imagine that chickenpox is an infection we all get, and for most of the people, most of the time, they're protected for the rest of their life. Now, compare that to a tetanus shot, where you get very good protective immunity, but it doesn't last forever. And that's why we have to go back and get a booster shot. And the third example would be HIV. People who are living with HIV have a lot of antibodies, have a lot of immune responses to the virus, but it does them no good in clearing the virus or keeping them from infecting others. So what we hope is that this virus will follow the chickenpox example, where if you get sick, you're protected for the rest of your life. What we fear is it might be like the HIV example, where you will generate an antibody. We will be able to tell if you were infected or not, but you may not be protected from infection again. And what we expect is that it's going to be like the tetanus example, where there's some protective immunity, but it doesn't last forever. And that will obviously impact how increasing outbreaks or frequencies of this virus happen.
Professor Dawn Bodish studies the immune system at McMaster University in Ontario. Thank you for your time.
Thank you so much for having me.
We've all seen the various reports about how long coronavirus remains active on certain surfaces. A study in the Netherlands has found coronavirus in sewage. Hertjan Medema is one of the authors of the report. He's a professor at the KWR Water Research Institute and at Delft University of Technology. I thought, first of all, Hertjan, that the gut was capable of killing coronavirus. So how do you actually find it in human feces?
Well, it's actually quite commonly found in human feces. The most recent reports that are emerging state that even as high as 50% of people reported with COVID-19 shed the virus in their stool, and also that the virus can multiply within the intestinal tract. Not only in the lungs, but also in the intestines.
So does the virus remain active once it's in sewage, and are sewage workers at risk?
Yeah, that's a question that many people have in and around the sewer community, if I can call it that. Researchers that have been looking in stool have been trying to culture the virus out of stools, and there are two reports from China showing that they can do it, but only with a few cases, and a report from Germany that state that they can't. So we think that the infectivity of the virus may not be that high and that the virus is not very robust, so that in the sewer system, which is a hostile environment for this virus, that it will rapidly be inactivated if it's infectious still after being shed. Of course, sewers are filled with all kinds of nasty bugs. So there are normal protective measures, protective equipment recommended for certain activities where the exposure risk is high. And all the recommendations are that these normal protective measures also protect against this new virus.
How rapidly would coronavirus die off in sewage, and what are the risks for the general public?
We don't have data yet on inactivation in sewer systems. We have inactivation data of what I tend to call his nephew, SARS-1, the virus with the epidemic in 2002 and 3. The data suggests that it dies within 2 days at 20 degrees and within 2 weeks at 4 degrees in sewer systems. So that is more rapidly than most of the viruses that we already know about that are transmitted through the waterborne route.
20 degrees Celsius, that's about 70 Fahrenheit. So you studied waste in the city of Amersfoort and found the virus before any cases were reported there in individuals. Is that a clue as to how your discovery might be useful in dealing with the coronavirus?
We feel that with this particular virus, there's more circulation than we see in the numbers of the health surveillance. And that's why I think sewage surveillance is particularly helpful in understanding this wider circulation of the virus and maybe even earlier than the health surveillance, because I think we were 5 days to a week earlier than the reported case. So if you could use this, then I think you can at least have early warnings to see if the virus enters a community or if it re-emerges again, for instance, in the winter. So I think, yes, sewage surveillance can certainly complement what we do in health surveillance and probably serve as an early warning tool.
I mean, it sounds like a crucial way of tracking spread, tracking sewage.
And a relatively straightforward way. With one sample, we can sample 10,000 or 100,000 people. So sewer surveillance appears to be pretty sensitive.
Hertjan Medema co-authored a report on tracking coronavirus in human sewage. He's professor at the KWR Water Research Institute in the Netherlands. Hertjan, thank you very much.
You're very welcome.
News headlines are coming up. You're with the world. In times of a pandemic, rival gangs in South Africa are laying down their arms and handing out food together.
What we're seeing happening here today is literally a miracle. It's absolutely incredible.
Plus, an American Fulbright scholar in Beijing takes on a new job, getting medical equipment in China for U.S. hospitals. The story's still ahead here on The World. Ask any New Yorker and they'll tell you, bodegas are an important fixture in their city. The small corner stores sell everything from milk and eggs to cat food and rolling papers. But with the coronavirus, many of these stores are shut down. Ones that are still open face a huge challenge, how to keep running while making sure the staff stay safe. Here's the world's Shirin Jafari.
Let me step outside.
20-year-old Nassim Al-Montasser has been helping out at his parents' grocery store in Brighton Beach, Brooklyn. He's a college student, but now that schools are closed, he's spending more time at the bodega.
It gets very busy. I mean, we sell fruits and vegetables.
As the coronavirus pandemic has ravaged much of New York City, some bodegas shut down or cut their hours. But for the Al-Montasser family, things have gone the opposite direction. Demand skyrocketed. And so Nassim's parents decided to keep the store open 24 hours a day. It's good business for sure, but Nassim says it's also stressful.
I have never thought of fear going to work. Simple fear, like waking up the next day.
A lot of the fear comes from not having enough protective gear, like masks and gloves.
It's been over a month where we've been using the same gloves. We've been using the same masks, and that's unsanitary itself.
Bodegas can be a coronavirus minefield, often small, cramped spaces with little room for social distancing. Some stores have put up plexiglass, Nassim says, that separates the employees from customers. But at his workplace, they haven't done that. In some neighborhoods, bodegas provide more than 80% of the food that people buy. That's according to a report put out by the city. And many of these businesses are owned and operated by immigrants.
90% of Yemeni Americans are actually merchants.
Dabi Al-Montasser heads the Yemeni Merchants Association, a group that represents more than 4,000 small business owners across New York City. She says when the outbreak began, many bodega workers didn't realize how serious it is.
Because many of our bodega owners, as well as their workers, work, 12 to 14 hour shifts, they don't have the luxury to follow the news and to, keep up to date on everything.
In some cases, she says, language is a barrier. So her organization started translating educational material about COVID-19 and send them out to bodegas across town. And now they've launched a campaign to donate safety kits.
3 to 5 masks, a bottle of hand sanitizer, and a box of 100 latex gloves that they can use, during their operating hours.
These items have been in short supply in New York City. Al-Montasser says she's relied on personal contacts to get a hold of masks and gloves from China. She says the city has agreed to waive tariffs on them. New York City has a department that works with small businesses. I asked them about protective gear for bodega workers and they didn't respond. Ali Zandani is a deli shop employee. He tells me he's still waiting on new masks.
This one mask has been on me for like a week and a half now, which you're supposed to change every 6 hours.
Zandani is a high school student. He's been helping out at his father's business called the 10 Star Deli.
I work a couple of blocks from the Brooklyn Hospital, which also has the 2 trailers where all the dead bodies are in.
Zandani says it gives him chills to think about the trailers. Sometimes the nurses from the hospital stop by the store.
They come and they tell us their experience, like what they have, that they see people dying in front of their own eyes, which is very sad.
They give him advice on how to sanitize surfaces in the deli and how to keep safe. He's doing his best, he says, but he knows coming into work is risky.
So I get home and it's hard. As soon as I walk into the house, I don't want to, like, for example, catch it while I'm outside and pass it on to my sisters and my family. And I have my grandma, she's upstairs, where she's pretty old, and I don't want to pass that on to her.
Several bodega workers tell me they feel like they don't have a choice but to keep their businesses open. Their neighbors depend on them, and they have bills to pay too. Here's Nasim Al-Montasser again.
We are the scene, right? We are what's going on in New York City. People are coming to us. A lot of supermarkets are closed. We really need people to take this seriously.
So far, the Yemeni Merchants Association knows of at least 65 bodega employees who've tested positive for COVID-19. And it says more than a dozen people have died from the disease. For The World, I'm Shirin Jafari.
Adam Carter was a Fulbright scholar teaching 8th grade in Beijing when the coronavirus outbreak hit. His school was shut down. With his newfound extra time, he got an idea: work as a middleman and help supply Chinese-made masks and gloves to hospitals back in the States that were desperate for them. It seemed like a no-brainer, but then Adam Carter actually tried it.
I wish I could, sit here and tell you that it's been a massive success and that I've, successfully sent over millions of masks, but actually it's been a lot more difficult than I anticipated. I've learned a lot about the industry here and a lot about the current situation and some of those roadblocks.
So how much luck have you had connecting Chinese suppliers of PPE, things like masks and gloves, back to hospitals in need in the U.S.?
Well, I've been really careful not to, push through any deals that are in jeopardy of, not arriving or not getting through customs. And the safest way to get around that is to really buy them at a retail and send them FedEx. So I've got a shipment of 50 KN95 masks on their way now to a family of doctors in Boston. And I'm working with a local partner to try to push through some bigger scale deals. So that's where we're at right now.
Has it been disappointing?
I mean, it has been disappointing. I mean, it's an education. And I think any industry, we can't expect to just step in and master it. I didn't know the intricacies. I didn't know the level of bureaucracy that I was up against. obviously, you know, we go in with good intentions, and sometimes we learn a hard lesson. Luckily, there were no, you know, deals that went awry, and there's nobody missing any equipment or anything. So, yeah, it's been disappointing, but at the same time, we're moving forward and hoping that this new partnership now will help us deliver some badly needed PPE into the States and beyond.
Explain how you came to all of this. How did you identify the need back in the States? I mean, it's in Chicago specifically that you were intending to help out. And what roadblocks did you encounter connecting Chinese suppliers of personal protective equipment, like masks and gloves?
I was in touch with a friend of mine from Boston, actually, and her family are doctors. And she contacted me and said her father's hospital was in need of some of these masks. So I thought, well, sure, let me see what I can do. You know, I started doing some research and trying to find Chinese suppliers that would be able to, you know, ship this stuff over there. What I've come to learn is that, as one person told me, it's belligerent chaos right now. Basically, a lot of Chinese suppliers have started producing these PPE, mainly because the economy obviously slowed here in China, and a lot of factories found themselves idle and realized there's a huge demand. So they started making these masks and equipment like that. So as a result, you have just a lot of new players. You really don't know who they are. And there's a lot of, you know, bureaucracy, obviously, certification that needs to be approved and verified before it can be shipped out.
You're also doing this in the midst of a pandemic, we have to remember. Are you concerned about getting infected yourself?
No, I'm really not concerned. Here in China, there have been no transmissions in China in the last few days. In fact, I know Beijing has, in the last week, we haven't even had any transmissions here. So people are still being cautious, but it seems like it's much safer to be here in China than it is to be back home, for example.
Adam Carter was a Fulbright scholar teaching eighth grade in Beijing. He's still in Beijing, but is now trying to act as a broker connecting Chinese-made PPE to hospitals in the U.S. that need it. Adam, thank you very much for speaking with us.
It's been a pleasure, Marco. Thank you.
You might find what I'm about to say ironic, but coronavirus news is starting to feel like information overload. The important science is nonstop. The news updates are constant. Not everyone, though, on this planet is so hyperconnected. In Mexico, radio stations are trying to fill in some critical gaps. Here's reporter Lorena Rios.
Every night at 7 p.m., there's a new ritual in Mexico when many people hear a message they know by heart.
Quédate en casa. Quédate en casa.
Stay home, says Hugo López-Gatell, Mexico's deputy health minister. He speaks with his team on stage at the National Palace, Mexico's White House. They go over the latest coronavirus numbers. It's a lot of charts and graphs, but health officials have also created a superhero cartoon to get their messages across. Susana Distancia, or Healthy Distance in Spanish.
Hola, soy Susana Distancia. Tengo un superpoder que me ayuda a frenar al COVID-19.
She wears a Wonder Woman-style leotard, hot pink boots, and she extends her arms out, creating a bubble of distance around her. She's all over the internet. But not everyone sees these campaigns. Nearly one-third of Mexico's population lacks internet access. That's about 40 million people. One radio station is trying to bridge the digital gap here in the indigenous Yaqui language. La Voz de los Tres Ríos, or The Voice of the Three Rivers, is a tiny station in Echojoa, in the northern state of Sonora. It's a rural area where internet access isn't a given, either because there's no signal or people can't afford it. Rita Amarilla Sanguamea has worked at the station since it began in the 90s.
Dios enchaneado, que chimaleya si me.
That's Amarillas, greeting listeners in another language spoken here, the Maya language.
Las radiodifusoras y radios comunitarias son muy importantes en las regiones apartadas del país, los cuales...
Switching to Spanish, Amarilla says indigenous and rural stations like hers are a key way people connect with each other.
En los programas de avisos comunitarios, los que están en otras regiones les mandan decir a sus...
She says people use the station to arrange basic phone calls with relatives. For example, someone will call in and say, "Hey, this message is for my sister. Tonight at 6, go up the hill where there's cell reception so that I can call you." But these days, Amarillas is focused on getting out news about the coronavirus.
Cuando la información se brinda en nuestra propia lengua, es cuando más...
Information reaches people best in their own language, she says. So, she's translating those government updates from Mexico City and other news about the virus into the indigenous languages spoken here. Stations like Amarillas are especially vital during a pandemic, says Jorge Bravo, who leads a group in Mexico that advocates for internet access. But, he says, more must be done to extend access to information.
Qué bueno que existe la radio comunitaria. Cumplen una función extraordinaria e insustituible.
Bravo says the government needs to bring the internet to these remote areas. In 2013, internet access became a constitutional right in Mexico. Health workers worry this digital gap is leading to a distorted view of the virus. Fidel Torres is a doctor who works in mountainous villages in southern Mexico. He hears people say the virus isn't real.
Muchos de ellos todavía piensan de que la enfermedad es algo que están inventando en la política, es algo que...
He says many patients think that the coronavirus is a government invention, and he worries they aren't social distancing or washing their hands enough.
A veces soy un poco drástico y les pongo como ejemplo que...
Sometimes he tells people, "Hey, does a relative have to die for you to believe this virus is real?" A good part of the airtime at Rita Amarillas' station features music popular in the area. But Amarillas knows her station has the responsibility to share health news at this time, too.
Nuestra audiencia confía mucho en la información que...
Our audience trusts the information we transmit, she says. Right now, she's working to make sure those messages get through, and in the languages that reach people the most. For the world... Lorena Ríos.
You've been hearing about some of the ways that animals have been taking back streets in these weeks of the outbreak, from wild goats wandering around a town in Wales to wild boars roaming the streets of Haifa in Israel. And now we know what happens when we keep our butts off the beach. The turtles make their move. Environmentalists in Thailand have found the largest number of nests in two decades of rare leatherback sea turtles. Video was recorded last month of newly hatched baby leatherbacks making their very first trips into the ocean at a beach in the Phungna district of Thailand. Tourist numbers have dwindled in Thailand, first because countries restricted travel, and later, Thailand put a nationwide curfew in place. Empty Thai beaches have led to a turtle baby boom. The leatherback turtle lays its eggs in dark areas where there is no movement, places that are obviously hard to find when tourists are on the beaches. So far, 11 turtle nests have been found. Leatherbacks are the world's largest sea turtles, and they are considered endangered in Thailand. One of the most controversial novels of the year has also been one of the most successful, American Dirt by Janine Cummings. Her novel has been on bestseller lists since it was published 3 months ago, but Mexican-American writers especially have criticized the book, saying the American writer's portrayal of Mexico was simply not accurate. It stings all the more because it turns out that annually, very few authors from Mexico are published in the U.S. The World's Jorge Valencia spoke with two well-known Mexican writers who have new English translations of their books coming out this spring.
Carmen Bollosa has been writing for decades. These last 2 weeks, writing from home in Mexico City, have been difficult. She says it's hard to focus.
My head has gone other place, and my fingers have gone other place, and my tongue is in another space, and it's been like an immense trip.
Bojosa has published 19 novels in Spanish. They've been praised across Latin America. Her newest just came out in English. It's called Book of Anna. She says it was inspired by a scene in Leo Tolstoy's famous epic, Anna Karenina. She says Tolstoy mentions in passing that Anna was working on her own novel.
And I thought when I read this passage, I thought if Anna had her book published, her life maybe would have been different.
In Book of Anna, the main characters watch a Rubinstein concert, they're present at the Bloody Sunday Massacre of St. Petersburg in 1905, and they find a manuscript of what Anna Karenina's novel would have been. It's like a set of Russian dolls, a story within another story.
It is exactly that, Matryoshka.
Bojosa's Book of Anna was published by the independent Coffee House Press based in Minneapolis. These days, it's hard to imagine one of the big corporate publishing houses, you know, Penguin Random House, Simon Schuster, putting out a novel that is written by a Mexican author that takes place in revolutionary Russia. And Bojosa knows that.
One thing I do see, and I always complain about, is how unfair is the English publishing system with writers of our continent that write in Spanish. I find it very disgusting.
Carmen is right.
Will Evans runs Deep Bellum, a nonprofit publisher in Dallas that specializes in international literature. He says the five big publishers have a narrow lens of what they want from international writers. If it's Latin America, that means immigration and crime. If it's Russia, then politics.
You know, when we publish writers from Russia, too, Russian writers are often misunderstood. Because if it's not directly addressing Putin and his system, like directly, then these writers are often not published.
Evans says that's why literature from Mexico and the rest of the world is so rarely published here in the U.S. The big publishers control most of the market, so only 3% of the books published in the United States every year are translated from other languages. Evans says writers like Carmen Bojosa and Fernanda Melchor, we'll hear from her in a minute, are just a sampling of rich traditions.
That is what is great about Mexican literature, is that you can write like a Central European. You can write like an East Asian writer. You can write like an American writer. You can write like a Mexican writer because Mexico is as much in the center of the world as the U.S. is. Everywhere is the center of the world to the people who are there.
Another center of the world is a small imaginary town on Mexico's Gulf Coast in the state of Veracruz. It's the setting for Hurricane Season, out last month by New Directions Publishing. Author Fernanda Melchor says she was surprised when it was picked up in other countries, first in Germany, then the UK, and now the US.
It's a novel that talks about Mexico and a small part of Mexico and has a really strong local color. And I thought that nobody will care about people from Mexico and from Veracruz.
The characters of Hurricane Season hang out in small family restaurants and in cantina bars. They listen to ballads by the singer Luis Miguel. No sé tú. The story revolves around the murder of the local town witch. It's violent, though it's not drug cartel violence. It's the violence that women in Mexico experience on a daily basis. Melchor says she wanted the novel to reflect true life, both in the story it tells and in the way Mexicans speak.
We're always trying to make double sense, to use innuendo, to spice things up and inventing words and mixing them with English. And it's always like this playful quality in Mexican Spanish.
Melchor is a relatively new writer. Hurricane Season is her second novel and the first one to be translated into English. Carmen Bojosa, author of Book of Anna and 18 other novels, says she's encouraged to see the success of younger writers like Melchor.
I admire how she could deal with such a terrible moment, terrible world in the novel, and do it so swiftly, so intelligently, so powerful. I admire her work. I love it.
Bojosa says there are many other Latin American writers doing great work, and hopefully those will make it into English, too. For the world, I'm Jorge Valencia.
Here's a great example of how opportunity lies within every crisis. In parts of Cape Town, South Africa, gang violence is a reality of daily life. But the coronavirus outbreak and a nationwide lockdown have brought about an unlikely truce. Pastor Andy Steele Smith works with gang members in his neighborhood in Cape Town, many of whom are convicted criminals.
The day that lockout started, I got a phone call from two different gang leaders, both saying, Andy, I've never asked you for anything, but we're starving. And I just thought, hey, if these guys are starving, they're at the top of the food chain. The rest of the community is going to be in serious, serious strife.
With Pastor Andy's help, rival gangs, the Americans and the Clever Kids, came together to help distribute food.
What we're seeing happening here today is literally a miracle. It's absolutely incredible.
These guys are the kingpins locally of their respective gangs. So working together to feed the community, to look after this community.
It is a nice story, but some local authorities are skeptical. Jean-Pierre Smith is with the Cape Town Committee for Safety and Security.
I don't suddenly become forgiving when a person who has held a community hostage shot other people up, engaged in extortion rackets and a torment of mayhem on a community, suddenly does something good and now we must all be forgiving and accommodating. So that doesn't for me wipe away or exonerate them from years or decades of torturing and holding those communities hostages.
But for residents of the neighborhood who are struggling to get by during the lockdown, any help is welcome.
There's no such thing as gangsterism. In these times, all of us stand together.
We rely on each other just to help one another, because if that people don't have something, we have to help them. And that's what we are based on here.
Cape Town residents Rashad Williams and Bridget Milan there. Here's hoping they can hold the peace and try to carry it over beyond the pandemic. Be ready for any surprises during these highly unusual times. Here's something else in South Africa that is not what it used to be. Music, specifically a style known as Om. This chill-out version of Om is from singer Diamantero, a track that came out a few weeks ago called Coronavirus Stay Home. Sound advice and a reminder that being stuck inside may test our patience, but home is familiar, and as the saying goes, there's no place like it. We come to you from the Nan and Bill Harris studio at WGBH in Boston. Follow Diamantero's wisdom. Stay home. I'm Marco Werman. Back with you tomorrow.
The World is a co-production of WGBH Boston, the BBC World Service, and PRX.